Code position number 14898, reel 6.
Reel 6. I think you were saying that there were about half a dozen men from your company who were left out of battle.
Well, yes, I suppose. I don't think I've jobs to remember exactly how many there were. But I moved up with this truck up Route 6 towards Rome, and finally we had kit. We stayed the night there near an airfield, I think. I can't remember exactly what the name of this place was, but I know we had a lorry load of kit bags, and the next morning we moved in through Rome, and I remember passing the Colosseum and to a place where the battalion had assembled, which was about 10 miles, I suppose, to the east of Rome. I suppose it was in the on the main road out to Tivoli.
What impression did Rome make on you?
We didn't see much of it.
You didn't, you just drove straight through.
Actually, I think the situation was then that Mark Clark had instructions to keep all the 8th Army out of Rome. That was his private preserve. In fact, I don't know whether you were aware of it, he had the road sign Roma cut down and sent home. Oh, he didn't move without a bevy of photographers with him, and his photograph was taken by this Roma sign and was promptly cut down and dispatched back to the States. actually, I met a chappie who was badly wounded. In fact, he lost his arm in a casino, and he was telling me how he was wounded and what happened. And I think our medical officer, MacArthur, took his arm off there. And he was lying in a casualty clearing station, and General Alexander came in, sort of have a smoke and all the rest of it, give him 10 of 50 players or something like that. And then a little while later, Mark Clark walked in with a bevy of wax, doling out packets of Lucky Strike. And this fellow came from Cardiff, who was of Italian descent, and he really looked it as well. And Mark Clark looked at his tag on it, and he says, "How come you got a name of Guy Carponini?" I think he thought he was really Italian. And he said, "My grandfather, sir." And then he had to explain how his grandfather got to Cardiff. Oh dear. Anyway, where were we?
You went through Rome, and you
out to this this assembly area where the battalion was, and I suppose we must have been there. I thought I made about 15 miles east of Rome, and we were there just waiting. I think we were in reserve. And the orders were given to move, and that usually you had these orders to move about 2 or 3 days before you actually did. And if we moved, 9 times out of 10 it was on a Sunday, or when the storm clouds had been gathering round. I remember getting heavier and heavier the atmosphere on Saturday, and then Sunday, the early hours of Sunday morning, it absolutely deluged. And of course, everyone was soaked. The blankets were full of water. And I remember we were trying to roll these blankets up, and you get we used to call them a Razmak fashion, which were an Indian way, of course, with the name, which were folded in a certain way, which were baled up and put on donkeys. Anyway, we were glad to get out of there, and we moved up. Out of there to towards Lake Trasimene.
You were saying also that on the way up you heard the news of D-Day.
Oh yes, that was back on Route 6. Yes. Yeah.
Did what sort of effect did that have on you?
Oh well, we're all very pleased to hear it, that someone had taken some of the pressure off of us. We were getting little or no news through. I don't suppose we were getting any more news of what was happening in France. than people at home, and there was just this, you know, our troops have landed on the shores of Normandy, and that was about it.
Just the BBC bulletins?
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me what happened at Lake Trasimeno.
Well, from there, it took us, I can't remember exactly how many days, but it was several days before we got up in that locality, and I think we had got, I think we, oh, there was the Surreys and the Somersets. The Somersets were in front of us because we went through their position, and it was all fairly quiet, a bit of spasmodic shelling, and we were in the D Company, in the lead, and all went well until we got to the crest of this hill or rise in the ground, some more of a bump, and then everything at once just hit us, woof, and we got down. There was no, we couldn't get any sort of shelter at all. I think there must have been about quite a few of us lying in a more or less a plough furrow, and you could see the bullets kicking up the dirt in front of you. And well, eventually, what happened is that there was a cry then, our platoon commander, so forth, somehow, I don't know, he managed to do it. But someone shouted out for him to, if he was there, to come up. And he came up, and so we heard about Mr. Caswell's been killed, the Colonel, Major Gill's been badly wounded, and all the rest of it. Well, it was, as I say, we didn't know, we were pinned down, we just could not move.
So the view ahead of you was a ploughed field.
Yes, well, and a hedge running down one side.
Yes.
The land sloped up the other side, which was the German positions. We were lying out in full view.
So you were attacking up a bare slope, effectively.
Down a bare slope.
No cover.
No cover at all.
Had you been given any idea where the German positions might be at your...
No, we didn't know. I think we went forward with the idea of finding out where they were.
This
we still found it.
This is the whole battalion.
The whole battalion, yes. Well, we were pinned down there, and on our left was B Company, and they were in the same fix as ourselves. I've talked to the company commander since Eldred Banfield, and we were talking about it, and he was wounded there. He was wounded in the leg, and he said he couldn't understand. He got down with his binoculars to see, and he fell over. Couldn't understand why, and then lying down there, and he noticed his trousers were soaked in blood.
He hadn't felt it.
He hadn't felt it, except something knocked him over. Yeah. And across on our right, there was one. How he on earth he got out there? There was a fellow by the name of Hancock who was came to me very worried that particular morning before we put an attack in that he'd lost his identity discs, his tags. And he'd made some, and even the coloured, the pinky coloured one, he'd found some paper which was pink, transparent cellophane sort of stuff, and managed to stick that on there. And I suppose it must have been, what, half an hour later he was killed. And whether he had a premonition or not, what was going to happen.
Can you tell me what time of day this attack?
Oh, first thing in the morning. Oh, probably 8, 7, 8, something like that. I can't remember exactly what time, hour of the day.
What was your start line like?
Well, we went through Somerset, and we know, well, presumably the Somerset, there was kit strewn about all over the place. And we just kept going. No, there was no sign of them. I think they... what had happened to them, I do not know, but I've got a darn good idea, but still, it was beside the point.
So you advanced through a litter of kit. What sort of formation were you in for this advance?
Well, we were a sort of
gunner.
Well,
yes.
I don't know about the companies on our. Oh, we more or less gone up in. Yes, I suppose. It's more or less in. I'll put it this way: more or less as I can remember, in a heap, I suppose.
So it wasn't a recognisable.
Well, we were sort of spread out, so. But I've. I. I I can't remember exactly what the lie of the land was. I got a feeling there was sort of a hedge or something on our right. And I know that when we got over the brow of this hill, there was only about a section of us, I think, and there was a hedge running down to the left. However, after all this, and when we couldn't move, and when the light started to fade, we decided to make a dash for it, and we dashed to this hedge, which offered us a certain amount of bank with some trees, and I couldn't remember if it was actually a hedge or what. But anyway, and then we made a dive for it one at a time, and as we ran, I don't know what number I was on the thing, but you could see the bullets hit in the earth from the German machine gun fire as each one ran. But what I was going to say before I got to that point, a company, as I say, Major Gill, who was our company commander, he was back the other side of the position, the company headquarters, the other side of the bridge. They were getting badly shelled. And he was killed, actually, and he was wounded. And as I say, that there was, at that stage, there was, well, I can't remember how many officers were left. I don't think there was anyone. I think there was a Price. Manley, the sergeant major, he got back, because we had no radio communication at all. He got back to battalion headquarters and found the colonel and told him what the situation was. And I forget now who came up, somebody rather, Manley, Sergeant Major Manley, was put in charge of the company. Well, eventually, another company came up through B Company, I think, which who were pinned down on our left. And they went down the other side of this hedge, and I can hear them now. There was you could hear them. They managed to get through, some of them did. And I can, you know, the cry was stretcher bearer, and so forth. I can hear it now. They lost quite. I couldn't tell you exactly how many. They must have had quite a few casualties there.
Roughly, what time would that be? Have you any idea?
That would probably be sometime during the afternoon, as far as I can remember. Probably about 3-4 o'clock, something like that, I suppose.
So, if I can try and get this straight, you come through the Somerset's positions, and there was rising ground ploughed in front of you.
Well, no, the rising, we didn't go, the ploughed ground was in front of us when we got to the top of this rise.
Rising ground, was that open?
There was a farm there as well, I remember. Yeah.
Was that open pasture then, the rising ground, or meadowland, or something like that?
Scrubby sort of land, as far as I can remember.
You advanced up to right, and as you came over the crest, was that then you came under fire?
That's right.
And was the fire coming from in front or from the side?
Oh, it was coming in front. It was probably coming in from in front and possibly, as we looked at it, from our right as well. It must have been.
And did the company go with one platoon up and two back, or two up and one back?
I think we went with one up and two back, as far as I can remember. But it may have been two up, because Bill Caswell was killed there. Bill Caswell, he was a Welshman, very nice chap, and he commanded 8th Platoon, I think it was. And the sergeant there, Sugar Candy, and it happened to him, this happened to him for the second time, first time it happened in North Africa, that he had a chap, someone was killed on either side of him, almost instantaneously. Bill Caswell put his head back, grab a drink out of his water bottle, and bang, it was it. He went down, and so the chap on the other side did. And Sugar Candy in the middle was not touched.
Did your own platoon, how were they laid out? Were they with two sections up and one back?
Well, I think you don't think of details like that. You just go.
You say the chaps on either side of Sugar Candy. Mm. How close would they have been?
Oh, a matter of a couple of yards.
So really quite closely.
As far as I can remember, on what I was told, yeah.
And the fire was machine gun and mortar.
Well, I should say that in those cases it was the same. It was a sniper. It was a sniper that had old Banfield and also this fellow Hancock, I know, and that was.
So he was targeting officers then, probably.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, say there was one officer. At that distance you couldn't tell. It's an awful job to tell who was an officer and who wasn't.
I mean, did you wear badges of rank when you went into battle?
Well, yes, I think so, but it wasn't shown very prominently, I can assure you.
But I mean, did the officers carry rifles to escape?
Oh, they carried rifles. Generally, Tommy guns.
Tommy guns.
Generally.
So that would mark them out from the general.
Well, no, I mean, say anyone with, I mean, say corporal, section leaders, and anyone would be able to carry a Tommy gun. Mm-hmm. They were quite a useful weapon, the Tommy gun. It was far better than the things that came after, those Sten guns. They were made out of gas piping or something like that. Yeah.
So this then sounds as though it was an attack that was stopped dead in its tracks.
Well, as far as we were concerned, yes, yes, as far as we were. But the attack went on through.
And presumably they were feeling their way around a flank or
Well, yes, they went on this. I forget it. It must have been C Company, I think, that went through us on our left, and they succeeded in pushing on. Obviously, I suppose the Germans then saw what was happening. This was happened. It was sort of all the way up through Italy. It was more or less a delaying actions all the way. Until they tried to establish the Gothic line, but we sort of really beat them to it. I remember, I can't think where it was. I think it was General Lees, might have been Cassino. I think it possibly was when he came round and he said, "Our objective is Vienna." And I remember a general election saying, "How the hell are we going to get to Vienna?" Well, if it hadn't been putting this attack in southern France, I think it was a possibility. However, there we are. Well, that was it. And from we were there, I suppose, the best part of on these positions, going from ridge to ridge, about 3 weeks. We moved on from there. I suppose about a couple of miles, and I remember we went through the Beds and Hearts, and it was a chap carrying by the name of Fox. He had a 38 set on his back, and I was behind him. We were going down a ditch, and there was a burst of fire. I think it was a rifle fire, and believe it or not, it shot it went through the webbing on his back. And shot the set wasn't hurt, and neither was he, but it cut right through this. It cut right through the webbing, as though it had been cut with a knife almost. And he was. I saw it happen in front of me. Same thing happened at Cassino with this chap we were trying to dig in with. The ground was so hard there, and he got out of his. Well, we so had I. Our small packs, and his was on a bit of a bank, and I, with my head down, I was looking up like that. I saw the buckle shot off his pack.
Near miss.
It was.
when, again, I'm sorry to keep going back to Trasimeno. Yeah. When the Germans opened fire on you at Trasimeno, do you have any idea of how far away they were when they first?
They were across the other side of this on the next ridge. How far? Now after all this time, about 300 yards, 400 yards, something like that.
It sounds like they'd got their positions at an ideal range.
Oh, they were just waiting for us. They had this prepared position between, I can't think of the name of the other lake, but around there they sat there waiting.
Did you see the German positions afterwards?
Well, I mean, so they were not to sort of take that much. Notice of them. We knew where they were. As far as that goes.
Did they differ in any substantial way from the positions you would have dug.
No,
not that I
remember. In fact, I mean, say a lot of these prepared positions were dug. Well, with a certain degree of, they were better prepared. They'd had more time to do it. I mean, so they used to get all sorts of people, Italians and goodness only what, in to prepare their positions in many cases.
So, if I can get this right, the advance went up. It was you were all pinned by mortar and machine gun fire.
Yeah.
You managed to get into cover of the bank. You heard the other company going up.
Yeah.
And then, what
well,
happened?
Well, we were still in the open, actually. We
yes.
weren't under much cover at all, but we heard them go through.
Yes.
And then, as I say, we got back up this track that was around the side of this hedge, back towards this farmhouse. And we dug in there on the crest. And I remember there some of this company coming, more or less crawling back, some of them very badly wounded. And as I say, we dug in there to get a bit of protection, because that night they really stonked us on this, because of course obviously by this time the Germans knew exactly where we were. excuse me. Not a lot of, strangely enough, I don't think, as far as I can remember, that night we suffered any casualties from shell fire.
Because you're presumably well dug in by the time it started.
Well, I mean, say you only had to get down a few feet, which often, you don't have to get down a great deal of depth to get a bit of cover, which was the main thing.
Did the battalion suffer very heavy casualties at Trasimene?
Yes. Yes, they lost quite a few there. I couldn't tell you exactly what the numbers were. But then I suppose it was just beyond this place. I remember when I was saying that we had the film show, which an odd aircraft was flying around. That must have been within a day of taking this position. Not Trasimene, we'd gone on, another company had gone through, and then we went through the Beds and Hearts. And, we were only finding then the odd, on our part, I think the company on our left found more, in a village, which was still held in strength. But we were sort of to the right, and I don't think we came more than about half a dozen of them.
So, effectively, then you were leapfrogging through the other battalions
right.
of the brigade, going
right.
forward,
yeah.
taking it in turns.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Germans, as I understand it, were taking up well-prepared positions.
Well, they had. They yeah. didn't have, after then, they pulled back again. And by then, we were getting, into the, really, it was around there, the Chianti territory, really.
So, the German policy then would be to stop you and hold you up and
that's right, all their
yeah.
way up through Italy, from ridge to ridge, from mountain to mountain.
When you're going forward again, what sort of distance would you cover in a day's march if you were advancing tactically in expectation of a meeting the enemy? How far could you manage to go?
Well, we usually had, on this occasion, going through the Beds and Hearts, which I can remember, I don't suppose, and we went through the German, our old positions and where the Germans had been, along this road, I remember. I suppose we covered a distance of not more than about 2 or 3 miles, I suppose.
Well, that would be quite a long distance if you were moving tactically.
Yeah.
Back
yeah. Well, we're just waiting. You're waiting till you bump something, really.
Mm.
And as I say, it was just past this Beds and Hearts position when this chap Les Fox had the straps of his .38 set shot through. And then I remember we attacked. We went down with towards some farm buildings. I remember. And there was a German, we lost one fella there. They were setting up a machine gun in the middle of a track. and they loosed off a few rounds, I think, and someone, I forget exactly, I know they hit one fellow who was badly wounded, and he eventually died, I think, of his wounds. He was hit in the lung. And, well, there, as I say, we stopped for a day or so, and I think, and then we moved on. The East Surreys had gone on, and they were encamped on a hill, well, pretty steepish place, really. I can't think of the name of the village, but I know we eventually, from there, moved forward into a position with some artillery guns. I think there was quite a collection of them, 28 pounders and 5.5s and all sorts of things there. In fact, there was a village, I suppose it must have been about 2 or 3 miles away. They were firing air bursts over the top of this village. Anyway, we're there, nothing much happened. And it was then we had some, Tony Spencer, who became a platoon commander, he joined us there. And we were there a few days, and then we went forward. We did a night march, and we took over on this hill from the Surreys. And
do you remember where that was?
Well, all I can tell you, it was southwest or to the west of Arezzo. It was in that locality. But there was, I suppose we were there for about 10 days, maybe as long as that. And we were continually getting shelled and mortar. That was all the thing that was going on there. The things that stick in your mind, I remember, I don't think any cigarettes had come up with the rations, or someone was short of cigarettes. As regards myself, I smoked a pipe as well in those days, and I used to find that smoking, it seemed to dry your mouth up more than it was, and all I wanted to do was drink. And but there was this moaning going on about, including Tony Spencer and one or two others, who was up platoon commander, saying they didn't have anything to smoke. And I remember getting my tobacco pouch out. I had some tobacco in there, but it was that it almost got something like sand. It was all dry. And I said, you chaps can get a smoke if you're welcome to this, if you can get anything out of it. And I threw it back, and I could hear a lot of scrabbling of paper and rustling and so forth going on. And suddenly, someone said, look out, look out. And the next thing I knew, they were trying to beat the camouflage, which had caught fire. They were trying to beat it out with steel helmets. So that was the end of their experiment in smoking. But needless to say, that the it was spotted, and down came the usual barrage of mortar shells.
I mean, the smoke was spotted. Smoke.
Well, I should think they must have seen something or other, because it happened to. They got it out. They got this fire out. But what happened? You get this. You could hear them when you could hear plop, 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 and then the next thing, all these mortar shells would come whistling down, and then the explosions were going on, they'd stick a couple more in for good luck. So by the time we think, oh, that's gone, down would come about two or three more. However, from this position, they did put in a bit of attack one night, and nothing much happened. I think a couple of signalers were, one was killed. And anyway, we were relieved by another company, and
this German attack, you said they put in a bit of an attack, was this a fighting patrol or anything more formal?
I don't think it was much more than that. I know they shelled and stomped and so forth and kicked up a bit of a row, and I think it was prior, more or less, to the time that they were thought about pulling back. Because I think it was the New Zealanders or Canadians, I can't remember which, had attacked round through Arezzo, and they were beginning to become in danger of becoming outflanked.
Did you see any of them yourself?
What, the Germans?
Attack?
No, I didn't, no.
This was at night?
This was at night, yeah, yeah.
As
a matter of fact, the only German we saw up there was a chap came walking in, decorating himself with bits of white in his rags and in his steel helmet and carrying a couple of handkerchiefs. He'd had enough.
What happened to him?
Well, we were whistled him back as a prisoner. But what I was going to say that I can't remember exactly how long we had been there. Another company relieved us and we went down in this village at the bottom of the hill. And I remember I had some breakfast, and there was a church there with a hole in the roof, and there was a piano in this church. There was a fellow in there with his steel helmet on the back of his head and a cigarette in his mouth, doing a little honky-tonk business. And just at that moment, some three Italian women appeared from somewhere and other. Oh my God, Father's Mamma Mia, you know. And anyway, I think it was Sergeant Major Mandy appeared with the priest's vestments on. And however, I managed to get a wash and shave, feeling a little bit better, and I got my head down for to sleep, and then the next minute was pack up, we're going back up.